You're listening to the Makers and Mystics podcast. This is season 13, episode 7. Before we get into today's show, I have to take a moment and say thank you to everyone who attended our recent The Breath in the Clay event in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I don't know what was more impactful to me, whether it was the performances and presenters, the art gallery and workshops, or whether it was simply getting the time to meet many of you, share stories, and hear about how the podcast has been a fixture in your lives for many years. But the reason I wanted to share about it here is because many of you have reached out to me since the event and have asked how we can keep in touch throughout the year. So I wanted to remind you that the Makers and Mystics Creative Collective is available for anyone who wants to go deeper into these conversations and form community with other listeners of the show. As a monthly patron, you'll be able to meet with our community online every second Tuesday of the month for an artist check-in, as well as attend our bi-monthly book clubs. The artist check-ins are a beautiful time where we can hear from one another and encourage each other along the way. And our next book club starts May 1st when we're going to read through the book Rembrandt is in the Wind. And lastly, I want to give you a quick hint about something you'll be hearing more about in the future. I have a brand new online course coming out called Poema. Poema is a collection of 22 short talks about the creative process and the spiritual life. And as patrons, you'll be the first to sample some of these sessions. So there's a few ways to stay connected, my friends. And now, let's get on to the show. Kristen Leanne is a multidisciplinary artist who creates an innovative brand of musical storytelling. She disrupts the classical genre by integrating innovative technology and collaborating with artists and musicians from many mediums. Kristen has performed for a diverse network of audiences around the globe, from the Dalai Lama to the Burning Man Festival. Through her lifelong devotion to the viola and her innovative use of guitar pedals, loops, and electronic soundscapes, Kristen's compositions and performances create a multifaceted musical landscape that bridges worlds and ideas. In our conversation, Kristen shares with me about her pursuit of mastery, the role of discipline and spontaneity in her work, and how she experiences the flow state in her performances. I'm your host, Stephen Roach, and this is Mastery and the Flow State with Kristen Leanne. Kristen, thank you so much for joining me today on the Makers and Mystics podcast.
Thank you for having me. Honored to be here.
I believe that I read about you that sometimes musical instruments choose you. For an unexplainable reason, a particular sound draws you in. And I'd love to know about that experience with you and the viola. How did this instrument choose you and how did you get drawn into this?
It's such a rare instrument that sometimes I think, why the viola? Why couldn't it be a guitar? You know, like, why is it such an unusual instrument? And it came into my life because my older brother plays the viola, and he's 3 years older than me. And so I would listen to him when I was really small, like 6 years old, practice this instrument. And it just, there was something there. It was beautiful. And at 6 years old, I had all these ideas of what I would do with it. And I was so young, and I knew immediately that sound was a superpower. And I knew that if I could put my hands on this thing, I could say so many things with just one note. And so it was love at first sight, love at first sound, I would say.
And so is that primarily the only instrument that you devoted yourself to, or has that lifelong love for the viola always been the sole instrument for you?
It's the primary instrument. You know, I call it my axe. It's definitely the one I'm most trained on. I also play keys, and I have a bass guitar. I play the kalimba and harmonica. I have a Moog synthesizer. So I can pick up a lot of instruments, but I don't play them nearly as well as the viola. That's where I'm very formally trained. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Well, I do know about your music that you have a lot of electronics, a lot of soundscape, a lot of cinematic appeal to your sound. Is that something that you developed over the years, or when did you begin incorporating some of that to your music?
It was a while ago. So all through elementary school, all the way to finishing high school, I played in orchestras, and I liked it in terms of the training, and it's pretty amazing to play with a 100-piece orchestra, but I knew the whole time it wasn't my final destination kind of thing. I'm very much a soloist and a lead. Violas are traditionally, we have harmony parts in the middle parts, and we don't get melodies very often. So the orchestra scene was what it was. I loved it, but it was not my future. And I did walk away from music for a little bit and studied storytelling and film, but then I came back to it when I was moving and living in Los Angeles and working in the film industry. And I really just missed it. It was haunting that I wasn't playing, and it was haunting that I wasn't composing. It wasn't just about playing. It's very much about composing. And so I started playing again with DJs and bands, but, you know, to have a worthy sound in that scene, I had to be electronic. And then immediately it was boredom almost. I would call it just the need to be creatively satisfied that I started buying guitar effects to have more diversity in sound. And then as I was playing with these other bands and DJs, that also wasn't fully satisfying. And so it was the composer in me that needed really to live. And the fastest way to that was looping pedals.
Yes.
So I started buying looping pedals, and looping is just so fun and easy and just creatively satisfying and self-reliant. And so I just really, then the composing really just, it just came out of me.
Well, you mentioned working in the film industry. Were you working as a composer in the film industry? Because when I listen to your music, that's one of the first characteristics I take away, is that it's a very visual music. For me, when I hear your sound, I see things that come with it. So I'm curious if the film background is something that's always been there also.
So the writer in me, I've been writing since as long as I've been playing viola, and I've been directing things. I mean, I literally wrote and directed a play in elementary school, you know? So the storyteller in me has always equally been there. So what I actually didn't get my university degree in music. I was trained to be a writer-director. So it was a literature and communications with a focus on filmmaking. And so, no, I was not composing films when I came to LA. I did development of screenplays. And I worked, my first job out of college was working for the actor John Cusack and his production company. I would read all kinds of hundreds of scripts. And I was learning how to develop films. I was learning how they're produced in the Hollywood machine, because I thought I was going to be a writer-director. And it was while I was working for John Cusack was when I started playing my viola again.
Yeah.
Because it was really my soul. Could not play, you know?
Yes.
It's a real part of me. I missed it. And live performance is one of my favorite things. It was the inner need to compose and perform that couldn't be ignored. I do think, though, because I'm so trained in storytelling, it is a huge part of my creative process. So I'm not surprised you can hear it in the music.
One particular song of yours that I'd love for you to tell us about today is the song Love of Fate.
Love of Fate is the title is the English translation of the Latin term amor fati. I don't know if you've heard of this, but love of fate, amor fati, is when you come to a place in your life where you love and appreciate everything that ever happened to you, including the bad, and everything that had to happen to you in order for you to be alive. And it comes probably later in life, because you have to get to a point where you are grateful to be who you are, holy, and grateful to be here. But in order to be truly grateful for who you are, you have to accept all of it, right, that true feeling. So that's what the concept is. And so the song is my attempt to encapsulate that feeling, both in regards to when I was composing it, in regards to my own life, because I have an origin story that is a bit tumultuous and I had to find my own way to Amor Fati. And because that album, that Love of Fate, is from my album Elpis, which is also an album with a story to it. So there's a character, the Elpis character also has to figure out how to fall in love with her, what is her fate.
You mentioned a tumultuous origin story in your own life. Is that something you'd be willing to share about?
Sure, yeah. My parents met in the Vietnam War.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm half Vietnamese. My dad's American. He was drafted. My mom is from Vietnam. And they met at the end of that war. And they're adorable. They're still together and in love. But the fact is, if that war didn't happen, I wouldn't be alive. Mm. And you know, when you look at my nuclear family, it's quite healthy and I'm very wanted and loved. But as soon as you go outside of that, the Vietnam War was incredibly traumatic for Americans. And I don't know if in this day and age it's talked about enough, but in terms of the baby boomer generation, it was a huge wound. And so when I was growing up, I'm talking all the way from being a toddler, when people would find out that I was a product of the war, that I was mixed race, that I was Vietnamese, they would say terrible, terrible things to me about my right to exist.
Wow.
Sometimes it was racist. Sometimes it was just their hatred of the war. I was some sort of symbolic projection of that war when I was young. Mm-hmm. So things like, you know, I'm 6 years old and someone says, if 2 million people didn't die, you wouldn't be here. Or, you know, all those people had to die for you to exist. What does that feel like? And I'm like, 9, or like, you know what I mean? Or like, yeah, wow. People say, I've heard forever the expression, which I shouldn't take personally, but when you're a child, you don't know, but that expression of like, nothing good comes from a war, which people say over and over again. And you're a child. It was just like from the jump, an existential crisis, mm-hmm. You know? And so it really, luckily in my home, it was full of love, right? So the foundation was solid. But out in the world, it was always this tense questioning of my right to be here. And so I really was forced to create meaning for my existence.
Yeah.
You know, and to me, and I have, and it took a long time and took forgiveness and it took healing and it took really having to understand the reality of life. But the way I look at it is I am proof that beauty, and my music is proof that beauty can come from incredible darkness.
Absolutely. Well, for one, I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad that this music is here to tell that story, that incredible beauty can come from incredible darkness. And as you were talking, the question comes to mind, because this season on the podcast, we're talking about culture and community and how these things impact the life of the artist. And I'd be curious to know a little about how this culturally diverse background that you come from, how that has impacted you as an artist, and how that has even found its way into your musical expressions. Of course, the story you just shared being a tremendous part of that, but how has the cultural diversity of your own heritage played a role in your storytelling through music?
I think enormous. I think it's a huge... My lens on the world is very this. Like for example, I don't pick sides very easily. It's very hard for me to get extreme. I'm very able. I think I'm more able to look at darkness than some people I've learned through the years. I'm very able to hold contradicting ideas cognitive dissonance.
Yes.
Philosophically, well. And I, as a person, my shows and my music, there's a huge pattern of me being able to help people, steward people through dark times, or help them recapture and reconnect to beauty. There's a lot of people I have, after my shows, have said things like, thank you for helping me feel feelings I didn't even know I had or I was disconnected to. All the way to the amount of people I've had say that they didn't take their own life because of me is a lot. It's quite a bit, like dozens and dozens of people, whether it's music or a perspective I offered or just the experience of my concerts. There's something about, I credit a lot of that to my heritage and just coming from both sides of the world and coming from conflict, that there's the reservoir in me. I'm used to it, but as I get older, I see it's a bit rare and different.
You've been a composer for your entire life, pretty much. You've devoted yourself to this one in particular instrument, which is such an incredible quality, such an incredible path. But I'd be curious to know, even as you talked about how this instrument kind of chose you as the vehicle of this expression in your life, there's a lot of discipline that goes into being a lifelong composer, learning, running the scales, learning how to speak this language, but then also letting the creative process guide you. Talk to me about how discipline and spontaneity work together in your life and how this discipline that you've had to develop over the years, how does that serve the unexpected parts of creating?
I love this topic because I love the topic of mastery. I just find it worthwhile for every human to explore if you want to just, you know, see your potential. If you have a high belief in yourself or you want to have a high belief in yourself, I find the path of mastery just fascinating. And discipline to me is a positive word. Discipline equates to freedom in my mind. It's like there's like a they measure against each other. And I know for some people it has like a stressful connotation, probably for reasons of like how they were disciplined in the past, and discipline is not easy. But there's so many phases to creativity. And I think the technical skill phase that requires a lot of discipline is only level one. And there's multiple levels to go after that, but you cannot access them without getting through level one. And I'm classically trained, and that is a gnarly, gnarly style of training, which is great. But you also have to break free from it. So, this instrument, the viola in particular, is incredibly complex between all the different skills that you have to learn to master it. But at the same time, that's, to me, why I love it so much, is because the quantity of textures and moods and emotions I could get out of this thing feels so endless, but I couldn't get that without the technical and the discipline training. So when I speak to kids or just people coming up, you know, and they're just in that unromantic, disciplined, technical skill phase, that's just labor. And not that romantic, honestly, right? Right. And like, listen, right. Like, get through it. Like, don't stop, and like, get to know how persistent you are, because learn everything and learn it so well that you forget everything. Mm. Because once you forget everything, then you can start working on your style. And that's like a whole other journey, is discovering your style, right? But you can't get to your style without forgetting all the technical stuff, because when you're focused on the technical, it's kind of like a certain mode in your brain, and it's like it requires all this focus, and it's worthy of your focus, but there is another place after that, right? So say you've gotten all the technical down, wonderful, congratulations. Now what style is yours? Like, how I release a note is going to be how different than how you release a note. And the way I choose to make certain notes swell and release, or punctuate or my style of composing, which, you know, sometimes it's really tender. Like, what's my sound of tender? And when I'm really ferocious, why? What are the choices I'm making? Once you find your own style, what's cool about that is you'd never have to worry about anyone ever being able to copy you, because it can't be copied. Mm. You're just one of a kind,
that's
right?
Beautiful.
And that's, to me, level two. I think there's other phases after that, right? You can, like, so what happens after you get through the discipline and the technical, and you learn it all so well that you forget it, and you found your style, what comes after that, right? Mm-hmm. I think level three is a conversation about flow state and presence and mastering that.
I mean, we can go there if you want to go there. I love talking about flow state. Flow state is where I live, my friend. You know what I mean?
Why do you love it? Tell me why you love it.
Well, because there's such transcendence in it, but it's also grounded. And that's the paradox. Maybe that's the same thing of holding two seemingly contradictory things at once that you're talking about earlier. But I love the flow state because it reminds us that there's something much larger than ourselves that we're also an important integral part of. And for me, I think even as you're talking about the discipline that is kind of phase one, that allows you to be able to enter into that flow state and navigate through the spontaneity, navigate through the uncertain movements. You've got that grounding, that language to come back to. And for me, because I write a lot of poetry, and which, by the way, thank you very much. I should just tell you this now. Your music accompanies me in many writing sessions.
I love that.
Yeah. But I can access that flow state because, you know, when you kind of create an atmosphere through your music, your art, I'm talking specifically about you at the moment, you know, through your music, you create an environment that then allows someone like me, who's going to interpret it through another art form, to just more easily get into that flow state, if that makes sense. So tell me your experience of flow.
What I do technically, actually, so I play my viola through guitar. There's like multiple guitar effect processors, and then that's the chain, and then it goes through a looping pedal. And for me to do that live and not make mistakes, I can't make mistakes when I play because they repeat, you know? And I don't, quantize is a term for anyone that's not a musician. Looping pedals have something called quantizing, where you can have the machine automatically make the timing of your loop perfect, but I don't even turn that on because I want to become a master of timing, right, and a master of what I do. So what I do on stage is harder than it looks. It's quite a tightrope. I hope I make it look easy. I want to make it look easy, but it requires absolute presence. In fact, the only time I'll ever make a mistake is when a thought enters my mind. Mm-hmm. I cannot whatsoever let a thought enter because then I'm not inside of the music.
Yes.
And what I do technically, emotionally, performatively requires absolute flow state. So I'm dropping into flow state all the time. You know, not even on stage at home too. It's just like, is this a requirement for me? And so,
yes.
The art of that is, the spontaneity you're talking about is so much about presence and self-trust. Mm-hmm. And how can you get that level of presence and self-trust if you haven't earned it and developed it and have experience with trusting yourself?
You know, in some of my own practices, and this kind of leans into some of my own particular spiritual journey, and it would be something like centering prayer or even the practice of silence. You would think silence is just something that you just come and you're quiet, but there's a whole discipline and practice of getting that inner silence and working through those distracting thoughts and those thoughts that take you away. And One practice I've learned to do is when I go to that place, I'll keep a little notebook beside me, and all the stray thoughts that come to me, I write them down so that I don't have to hold them in my mind, and then I can continue. But there does come a point when it seems like it's much easier just to kind of be in that space. And I'd be curious, are there practices that you've developed that help you when you're moving toward that flow state in your music that kind of stay the distracting thoughts that try to come to you?
I do categorize these interrupting thoughts as legitimate or illegitimate, I call them.
So, yes.
Yeah,
that's good.
So like, say I'm on stage. I mean, I'm human. It's not like I can't exist without thoughts. You know, it's just what do you do when they show up? So the mission is to acknowledge them and wipe them as fast as I can, like with like light mm-hmm. speed, like wipe them away. But but some thoughts are legitimate. A legitimate thought is like I'm playing and I might look down at my effects pedal and realize that I didn't change one of the settings that song I'm currently playing needs. And I'm like, whoa,
yes.
I need to somewhere
yes.
like that's a legitimate thought, right? Or like,
yes.
this cable's in my way. An illegitimate thought in that moment is, did I leave the iron on? Why is that person looking at me? What does so-and-so think?
Right.
Or that rude thing that someone said to me in the past. Like, those don't matter to the moment whatsoever. So if they come in, I acknowledge, I categorize. This is like as fast as humanly possible. Acknowledge, categorize, wipe. Like anything, the more you do it, the better you get. Right.
Yes.
And so sometimes a thought will creep in and I will feel it creep in before it even fully forms and I wipe it away. Like, that's kind of interesting, right?
Yes.
Sometimes the thought just happens and I make a mistake and I just laugh. Sometimes the thought is hilarious and I'm like, well, that was rude. Like, you know what I mean? And sometimes it's something full of anxiety, like any human, and I have to be compassionate towards myself and just let it go, you know?
This is so good. You know, I wanted to comment on the fact that you said, I make a mistake and I just laugh. Because when we talk about things like mastery, it seems that there immediately comes this strict posture of almost fear of making a mistake. You know, that a lot of times when we think about mastery, we suddenly take ourselves so serious. And obviously there is a seriousness to learning and developing that we have to have, but to be able to make a mistake and laugh, or even as you said, to have self-compassion, I think perhaps that is almost the necessary ingredients of mastery.
It's the secret sauce.
Mm-hmm.
It's the secret sauce. And I learned this from performance. If I'm on stage. It's happened. Like, it's so silly to think you're going to be perfect all the time. It's an absurd thought. So I've performed on stage quite a bit. And whatever you're embodying is what the audience is going to experience. And, you know, the stage is an extreme example, but you can take it to a one-on-one conversation, right? Whatever energy I am treating myself with, the audience is, I'm just a mirror. We're just mirrors of each other. So of course I've started a loop on stage that was not perfect, you know? At this stage, luckily, it's not that often, but of course, it'll totally happen. If I'm uncomfortable with that moment, if I'm embarrassed and awkward, the whole audience is gonna be awkward, right? And I know that as a performer, and if you're listening and you're a performer, like, you gotta, if you own your mistakes, you become so, but you're comfortable with it, you just become the most relatable person. And so I've made mistakes. The last show I had, it was the second song, and which is pretty early in the show. You don't want to make a mistake early in the show. You know what I mean? That you want the tallies getting pressed. It was the second song, and I started the loop. And I bet you no one else would have realized the timing of the loop was like slightly short. I'm probably no one would, but that didn't matter. Like, I knew. I knew the loop was, the first loop was not as good as it could be, and I knew that if I just let it go, I wasn't going to be as present as possible with the song. I wasn't going to enjoy myself. Therefore, it's not going to be as good, whether you know it or not. I know it's not going to be as good. So I stopped. You know, I could stop the loop and be like, oh, I'm so sorry, blah, blah, blah. And I didn't. I just like stopped and I looked at the audience and I was like, that wasn't good enough. And we deserve the best.
So good.
And everyone was like, yes, we do deserve the best. You know what I mean? And we just like giggled together. And I started the song. I'm like, I'm starting over. And no, not only do people not care, not only do people relate to you more, but all of a sudden the audience knew, oh my God, this is so real. And they were all leaning in more. And everything just became more present. We all just became more present.
I love it.
Mistakes are just a part of humanity. And if we just let each other make mistakes, we're just going to get closer to each other, I think.
I love that. That our mistakes can be a doorway to deeper connection.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Really beautiful. Well, one last question I want to ask you before we leave is, what would you say to some of our listeners and some of the creatives and artists who are coming up, part of the Makers and Mystics community, who are developing their own voice? Mm. How can we begin to develop our voice as artists?
Patience, persistence are two superpowers, I think. Persistence in that when you know it's going to take a long time and you're cool with that, and you kind of fall in love with, you hear it, fall in love with the journey, but it's really true. Like, if you know you're in it for the long haul, that's an advantage, and that will give you the level of persistence you need and the level of patience simultaneously. So I think really understanding that persistence and patience are superpowers. If you have a negative connotation to the word discipline, try to recontextualize that. Like, for me, again, discipline equates to freedom. You'll find your way out with some discipline, or through with some discipline. And there's actually a book that unpacks this process really well. It's called Mastery by Robert Greene. And I recently read it, and it's honestly one of the best books I've ever read on the topic. I just love this book. And he unpacks masters from Da Vinci to Mozart and everything in between, scientists.
Yeah.
And there are phases of mastery, and he unpacks every phase and how to be good at every phase. So when you can kind of see, you know, it's like when you see the hero's journey and you kind of locate yourself in the journey, all of a sudden your journey doesn't feel so overwhelming and you're like, oh, I'm in this phase. I got this way to go. Like,
yes.
And it's manageable. And if you're on the path to mastery and finding your own voice and style, and you want to go in on the long haul, it's similar to like the hero's journey, this book Mastery, where you kind of see where you are in different aspects that you're trying to master. You can be like, oh, I'm in this part of the apprentice phase. Okay, that makes sense. This is where I've been, and you can see how much you've accomplished already, and this is where I have to go. And that book was just genius to me on the topic. Mm-hmm. So I highly, highly recommend Mastery by Robert Greene.
Well, I'll put a link to that in the show notes so people can find that one as well.
Cool.
Well, Kristen, thank you so much for taking this time to talk with me today on the Makers and Mystics podcast. I'm a fan of your work. I really appreciate you as an artist, and it's been a real joy to have this conversation.
Thank you for having me, and I love your show too. And your episodes are so great. Your curiosity about the creative process and the human experience, I think, is just a deep well, so I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Makers and Mystics podcast. Be sure to see the show notes of this episode for links to the resources mentioned in today's show. And visit patreon.com/makersandmystics for additional interview segments with Kristen, including one on how Bruce Lee influences her creative life. We'll see you again next week. And until then, keep creating. The world needs your art.